listening on a long series in Joburg on God's building, and so you can see it's number 12. I actually preached one of them a while back when I was here as well. And I'm going to read with you from 1 Peter 2, verse 9 to 12. But I want you to just listen out for, there's a certain tension in the text. You know, things that seem to sort of pull against each other in the text, or push against each other in the text, that I want you to listen out for. Listen if you can hear the tension in this text while I read it. This is 1 Peter 2 from verse 9. It says, "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation." And then verse 21 says, "For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example, so that you may follow in his steps." Do you see the tension in the text? You see the tension that's there. What I saw immediately when I read the text was, it says that we must live in such a way among the Gentiles. We live among the Gentiles. We live in an unbelieving world. That's what Gentiles here represent. And they slander us as evildoers, and yet we're supposed to do good. Can you see there's like a we are God's holy people, God is a holy God, and we're trying to live faithfully to a holy God while also living fruitfully in a hostile world. And it seems like this holy God and this hostile world are sort of at loggerheads with one another. You know, we live in the world, but because we belong to God, we abstain from the world. So we still experience the temptations of the world, but we abstain from them. Later on in chapter 4, Peter goes on to say, you know, once you also lived in the same way that the pagans and that the world lives, you know, in all kinds of idolatry and sexual immorality and all that kind of stuff. And now they slander you and heap all kinds of abuse on you because you don't indulge in all of these things the way that they do. And they don't understand it. And the reality is we live in, as a holy nation, for a holy God, but in a hostile world. In other words, you know, the classic sort of challenge, we're in the world, but we're not of the world. We're in the world, and we're not of the world. And we all know about that reality, that we're in the world, but we're not of the world. But we don't often deal with that tension that results in, you know. Because we're not of this world, and because we're different from this world, there's this challenge of how do we live in this hostile world as holy people of God? And there's a definite tension, and I know if you're a Christian, you have experienced that, right? Any of you experienced that? To any of you that is a challenge? You struggle with that on a daily basis? You know, I live in a hostile world. Now, the other day, I went to a secondhand bookstore. I love secondhand bookstores. I like books, so you know, I like browsing those secondhand bookstores and finding those little gems that other people have missed. You know, a good book or so. And I found a book on humorous quotes, and I thought this looks interesting. Let me just grab it off the rack and page through it and have a look. You know what it has to say. And I picked up the book and started paging, and obviously I had sections on God and faith and Christianity and that kind of stuff. And what struck me was how consistently negative all the quotes were about God, about Christianity, and about religion, about faith. Consistently negative. Obviously, it's a book of humorous quotes, so, you know, it would usually portray God and Christianity in a mocking way, and in a very negative way. And, you know, I thought that was just, you know, so typical, you know. Sometimes when you're in a religious culture, and last when I was in Bloemfontein was quite religious, but even then, sometimes it's still hostile. Not hostile to religion, but hostile to real Christianity and to God. You know, it's one thing going through the motions, it's one thing doing the rituals, but it's another thing living for God. And the reality is, we do live in a hostile world, but we also belong to our holy God. So how do we navigate that tension between the two? And that's a big part of what the book of 1 Peter is about, and that this passage is about. And what I want to submit to you is that Peter's solution is the way to live faithfully to a holy God and fruitfully in a hostile world is to learn to live as resident aliens in this world. Resident aliens. In verse 11, he talks about sojourners and exiles. Okay. So let's have a look at that. My headings in the text will be, number one, we are a community of resident aliens. Number two, we are defined by God's grace. Number three, for declaring God's glory. And number four, for displaying God's goodness. Okay, so number one, we're a community of resident aliens, defined by God's grace, declaring God's glory, and displaying God's goodness. Now, if you have that tension of, okay, we're in the world, but we're not of the world, and we're different from the world, and the world, in a sense, is hostile towards us, the only way you can really live and resolve that tension is not on your own. You can only do it as part of a community. Sociologists tell us that typically, you know, when groups are different from the dominant culture in which they live, that they respond in one of three ways, typically. The first way is they try and fit in. They become like the dominant culture. They assimilate to the culture. They become like the culture. And in Jesus' day, if you just go up to the next slide, and put up the next slide. There should be a triangle. There we go. In Jesus' day, that was the Sadducees. Now, they were the political elite. In Jesus' day, they were also the priestly order, so they worked in the temple as priests, and they were sort of the heads of the Sanhedrin, which was the Jewish ruling council. And in the days of Alexander the Great, about 300 before Christ, Alexander the Great, one of the big things that he did was not only conquer the known world, but he Hellenized it. He made Greek the spoken language of the known world of that time. And he brought Greek culture in. And the Jews, many Orthodox Jews rejected that. The Sadducees and so on accepted that. They Hellenized. They started speaking Greek and so on. And they embraced Greek culture because they wanted to fit in. They wanted that political power that came with assimilating and fitting in. And they had a lot of political power. I mean, when Jesus braided that whip and started chasing the people out of the temple court, I mean, the Sadducees were some of the guys who lost, you know, were the biggest losers from that. Because how it worked was, Jerusalem, obviously capital city of Israel, you know, property is expensive. But the Sadducees, they were priests, they needed to be near the temple. And they were some of the few that actually had the money to afford property in Jerusalem, to be able to buy land in Jerusalem and be near the temple, because they used the whole temple system to make a lot of money. I mean, just imagine this. If you were a peasant living up in the north of Galilee, and you had to sacrifice three times a year on the three main festivals, you had to come down to Jerusalem to sacrifice and to be part of the festival. Now, it was very difficult to take your little goat and march all the way down from North Galilee to Jerusalem and, you know, sacrifice to go there. It was a lot of schlep. So what they would do was, they would rather sell it or take money that they had and travel lighter, and it's easier, and then they'll go and buy an animal to sacrifice. And obviously the Sadducees obliged, and they sold animals at the temple. But they sold them at exorbitant prices, which these poor peasants, Israelite peasants, couldn't afford. And they made a lot of money off this system. And because they assimilated, they spoke Greek, and they accepted Greek culture, they gained a political power. And they could maintain this system. Made a lot of money. I mean, even archaeologists tell us that even the bones of the Sadducees who lived in Jerusalem that they dug up were bigger in general than the average bones of the rest of people, people dug up in the rest of Israel, because they just ate so much better. You had less child mortality amongst the guys in Jerusalem because they were just so much richer. So these were the guys that said, no, the way to deal with the culture is you just fit in, you assimilate. And by that, by assimilating, you get the culture to regard you. They accept you, and they regard you, they respect you, and they think, oh, these guys, these are model citizens. And you gain all kinds of power. Now, the second way to deal with the culture is not to fit into the culture, but to fight the culture. In other words, to attack the culture. And the Pharisees are an example of that. They were big on the law, obeying the law, obeying Torah. And they said, no, we're different from the culture, and the way that we're going to deal with it is not to try and fit in, not to try and assimilate to the culture like the Sadducees. We are going to attack the culture. We're going to fight the culture. In fact, they are descendants of the so-called Maccabees. Maybe you've heard of the Maccabean Wars. They were guys who tried to kick out the Greek rulers, of their time. And they rejected, they tried not to Hellenize, If you Hellenized and you started speaking Greek and adopting Greek culture, they saw you as a traitor. They were very patriotic, these Pharisees. No. We must, our own language, maintain our own culture, and we must resist these foreign, pagan, Gentile cultures that are trying to impose themselves on us. Fighting the culture. And where there are many Christians today who are like the Sadducees, especially liberal Christians, try and fit in, try and assimilate to the culture. Can't really see much of a difference between the culture and the church, liberal churches. You get many so-called fundamentalist Christians who are like the Pharisees, who are attacking the culture. I heard a quote the other day where a guy was saying, so much of what we call cultural engagement is actually just cultural enragement. Because all we're doing is we're trying to fight the culture, we're trying to attack the culture, criticize the culture the whole time, and there's no constructive engagement. So all we're doing is we're making the culture angry and alienating the culture, making the culture defensive and distancing ourselves from the culture. And that's what the Pharisees did as well. And so often we as Christians react in that way too. And then there was a third group that said, no, we don't fit in, we don't fight, not fit in or fight, but flight. We don't assimilate to the culture, we don't attack the culture, we avoid the culture. And the Essenes were a group like that, a Jewish group like that. You might have heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Anyone heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls? Well, the Dead Sea Scrolls were written by a group of Essenes, and they were found in the late 1940s, after hundreds of years, actually thousands of years, more than 1,000 years, almost 1900 years, by archaeologists, and they were there because the Essenes lived. They were called the Dead Sea Scrolls because they were found in caves right next to the Dead Sea in Qumran. And they lived. They said, listen, they were also priestly order, just like the Sadducees. They said, we're not happy with what the Sadducees are doing, assimilating into the culture, buying political power and so on. And they're evil, they corrupt. They're not faithful to God. We're going to distance ourselves from them. We're going to start our own community out in the desert. We're going to avoid the culture. That's how we're going to deal with this challenge of being different from the culture. And they lived out there in the desert until, of course, the Romans conquered Israel, and they were also slaughtered. But their treasure, the biggest treasure, their scrolls, remain in the caves. And there are many Christians who try and respond to the culture like that also. The culture is different from us. The culture is hostile to us. So we're just going to avoid it. We're going to form our little holy huddle. We're going to form our little community, the holy huddle of escapist saints, and we're going to hide from the world. We're not going to have contact with the world. We're going to avoid contact with the world as much as possible, because we don't like the world and the world doesn't like us. And I mean, throughout the ages of church history, you've had so many monasteries and all kinds of stuff. You know, the desert fathers were called the desert fathers because they escaped into the desert to avoid the world. And so many Christians have thought the only way to be holy in a hostile world is to avoid the hostile world. I'm sure all of us have felt like that in some ways as well. And all of us feel a tug in one of those three directions, assimilate to the world. And sometimes we're tempted to assimilate to the world and become like the world. Sometimes we get angry and we're tempted to be like the Pharisees and attack the world, attack the culture. Sometimes we're like the Essenes and we just feel, you know, I give up. I just want to go and be by myself. You know, it's so much easier. You know, there's just so much temptation in the world. You know, everything on TV is just advertised with sex. You know, and you know, there's just, you know. You go into a conversation, you know, a group of people in the world, and it's just not edifying, it's just not building up. The only way I can live holy, you know, and I'm actually tempted by those same things. So the only way I can live holy is if I can avoid the world. I've heard many, you know, I've been tempted in that way myself, and I've heard many Christians say that. So these are the three options that typically movements, organizations, or groupings that are different from the dominant culture that they fall into. They either assimilate, they attack, or they avoid. But in come Jesus, in the next slide, in come Jesus and the Christians, the early Christians, and they responded in a radically different way. A radically different way. Jesus freaked out the Sadducees because he didn't fit in. He didn't assimilate to the culture. He was very different, and he, in many senses, undermined the culture and challenged the culture. But he also freaked out the Pharisees because he didn't attack the culture, and he didn't sort of remain aloof and say, oh, we're better than the culture like the Pharisees did. One of the things that freaked out the Pharisees the most is that Jesus hung out with prostitutes and tax collectors and other unsavory characters. One of the biggest accusations they brought against him is, he's a friend of sinners, and Jesus never denied it. He was. He hung out with sinners. He had no problem hanging out with sinners. Of course, he had no problem hanging out with the Pharisees as well. He spent time with them too. Okay? And then the Essenes, of course, they avoided everyone, so they avoided Jesus too. But Jesus didn't avoid the world. He didn't just attack the world, and he certainly didn't assimilate to the world. He responded in a different way. Now, what I want you to see is, firstly, all three of these options, assimilating, attacking, and avoiding the world, all three of those options, people do those things so that they will not suffer. Can you see that? That's important that you see that. If you assimilate to the world, you become like the world, then you don't have to suffer. Because the world accepts you. It regards you, thinks, ha, you know, you're like us. And it has regard for you, there's respect for you. The world respects you, regards you. You attack the world, then you can sort of harden yourself against the world and just attack the world. And when the world does hostile things, you just, you know, counterattack. You can harden your heart against the world, and you don't have to suffer. You know, they reject you, and they think you're weird, but you don't have to suffer. You avoid the world, you don't have to suffer. But what Jesus and the early Christians did was, they didn't assimilate to the world, they didn't attack the world, and they didn't avoid the world. So they had genuine engagement with the world, genuine life-on-life contact with the world, without becoming like the world. And that led to suffering. Jesus suffered. His disciples, his early disciples, suffered. But here's the other thing. None of those three options, assimilating, attacking, or avoiding, none of those three options changed the world. You become like the world. You assimilate to the world, and you cannot change the world. You cannot change the world by becoming like it. What are you going to tell them? Oh, become like us. And they're going to say, oh, we're already like you. In fact, you like us. You cannot change the world by becoming like it, by assimilating to it. You also cannot change the world by just attacking it. You just attack the world the whole time and you alienate. You sort of, the world puts up its defenses and puts up its walls and it doesn't want to receive from you anymore. It sees you as hostile and outside. And you cannot change the world. You avoid the world. The world cannot see you. So you can't change the world either. So none of those three options change the world. But what Jesus and the early Christians did, engaging the world while still remaining different from the world, that actually changed the world. And that's why, within a few generations, the early Greco-Roman world had become Christian, predominantly, in just a few hundred years. And that's the challenge that we face as well. So we're in the world, but not of the world. Verse 11, 1 Peter 2 verse 11 says that we are sojourners, and the word there means resident aliens, those who live in a place that is not their home. Or exiles, those staying for a while in a strange or foreign place, sojourning, residing temporarily. In other words, when Peter says that we are sojourners and exiles, he's saying that we are resident aliens. We live in the world, but we're not citizens of the world. Now, when I say aliens, I don't mean like, you know, Superman who's Clark Kent, you know. Who lives, you know, on planet Earth, but actually he's from Krypton, you know, he's Kal-El from Krypton. I don't mean aliens as in Men in Black aliens, okay? I mean aliens as in foreigners, you know? We are foreigners, but we're not just foreigners who are, on one hand, visiting a foreign country. We're not tourists, okay? We're not just visiting and then leaving, okay? We're actually residing there, we're living there, but we're also not settlers. Who settle and become part of the culture. We resident aliens. We retain our distinctiveness, our difference, and yet we become fully part of the culture and live in the culture. Resident aliens. Does that make sense? Now, how do we do that? How can you become a good community of resident aliens? I just firstly want you to notice something that I just want you to notice that community aspect. In verse 9 it says, you are a chosen nation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own special people. So the chosen race, plural, you know, race, a royal priesthood, a chosen nation, God's own special people, as in people group. Can you see there's a communal aspect to all of that? God has made us a community of resident aliens. And like I said, that's the first secret. The only way that we can live as a holy people in a hostile world is if we don't live alone. The only way you can live with this tension of being in the world but not of the world is if you live as part of a community. You cannot change the culture as a lone ranger, all by yourself. The only way you can change the culture is if you're part of a community. Individuals don't change cultures. Communities change cultures. Okay? Then, why did God make us a community of resident aliens like this? Or how? How do we become a community of resident aliens like this? Now, the first thing I want you to see is that it's by God's grace. That first verse, verse 9, and actually verse 10 as well, just saturated with God's grace. And I just want to show it to you quickly. First, it says that we are a chosen race. We are a chosen race. I'm going to read you a passage or two from the Old Testament, you know, because I want you to see where these ideas come from. The first one is in Exodus chapter 19. Now remember the context here. God is bringing Israel out of Egypt, out of slavery. And I'm going to read you just Exodus 19, verse 5 and 6. And I want you to hear, you can hear the echoes of this verse in the verse that we read in 2 Peter 2. Verse 5 and 6 say, now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Does that sound familiar? Verse 6, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Does that sound familiar? So, he says that you will be my special people. You will be chosen. Let me just read you
one more in Deuteronomy 7, verse, from verse 6. It says, "For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples on the face of the earth to be his people, his treasured possession. The Lord did not set his affection on you and choose you because you were more numerous than other peoples, for you were the fewest of all peoples. But it is because the Lord loved you and kept the oath that he swore to your ancestors, that he brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the land of slavery." So the first thing I want you to notice there is that we are a chosen people, not a choice people. See the difference? We're a chosen people, not a choice people. We're not a choice. I mean, it says of Israel, you were fewer. Actually, it means, like, of all the nations, you were the least impressive. It's not because you were so impressive that I chose you. It's not because you were so impressive. In other words, if you were a choice, it would be God chose us because we are special. But rather, it's the other way around. It's the converse. It's because God chose us that we are special. It's because God chose us and set his love on us that we are special. And it says that we are a priesthood, a royal priesthood. You are a royal priesthood. Notice it says you are a royal priesthood, not you have a royal priesthood. Can you see the difference? I mean, this freaked out the early Greco-Roman world. They didn't really know what to do with the Christians. In fact, they called them atheists. Can you believe that? You can go and read up in the early church history at some. The Greeks and Romans called the Christians atheists because, firstly, they had only one God, whereas the Greeks and Romans had many gods, okay? But they didn't call the Jews atheists. They only called the Christians atheists. So what was the difference? Because the Jews also only had one God, Yahweh, just like the Christians. Okay, obviously the Christians recognized Jesus as being part of the divine identity, you know, being himself Yahweh. So, but why didn't they call the Jews atheists and they called the Christians atheists? Because every other religion that they knew, the Romans knew, had a temple, had a priesthood, and had sacrifices. And here come these Christians, these Galileans, and they have no temple that they can point to. They have no special priesthood. In those days they knew, they had the sense that there's this divide, this chasm between, you know, gods and men. You know, there's this divide between divinity and humanity. All cultures knew that. And you need a spiritual elite who can mediate, who can build a bridge between divinity and humanity, between gods and people. And that's what the priests were. And they did the sacrifices, and they interceded for people. They built the bridges. They were the mediators between gods and men. And here come these Christians, and they have no spiritual elite. They have no priesthood. They are a priesthood. Every single Christian can approach their God by themselves. So no temple, no priesthood, and no sacrifices. They don't do sacrifices. Why? Because Jesus is our temple. Jesus is our priest. Jesus is our sacrifice. And therefore, in Christ, we are the temple, we are the priests, and we are the sacrifices. And the Romans just looked at this and said, we've never seen anything like this in our lives. We've never encountered any religion like this. These are a bunch of atheists. They have no temple, they have no priesthood, and they have no sacrifices. They're a bunch of atheists. They didn't know what to do with the Christians. But can you see the grace of God in that? You don't have to go to the temple. You are the temple. You don't need some other spiritual elite to mediate between you and God. You are the priesthood. You don't have to bring sacrifices. You are a living sacrifice, for crying out loud. Can you see the grace of God in that? Not only are we chosen, we're a royal priesthood. And then it says that you are a holy nation. In verse 9. You are a holy nation. Two verses later, in verse 11, it says,
you know, abstain from from carnal passions, from fleshly passions which war against your soul. So here's the problem. Not only are we still living in the world, but it seems the world is living in us. Have you heard the story of the Trojan horse? The Trojans, I mean, we have a saying in English, they defended like Trojans. If the Springboks really defend well and they keep out the All Blacks, then we say they defended like Trojans, because the Trojans were legendary for their defense of their city. They had great city walls, they had never been conquered, and they really fought, and they had a proud tradition of fighting to defend their city, and they'd never, the city walls had never been breached. They'd never been conquered, and they were very proud of it. And this army came from a king called Agamemnon, came and attacked their city again, and they fought against them, and eventually it was sort of a stalemate, and this one guy came up with this idea, and they pretended to pull back, the Agamemnon and his army pulled back with their ships, and they left this wooden horse on the beach. And the Trojans came out and they just saw a few bodies scattered, the enemies, and this wooden horse, and they thought, ha, we've done it again. We've repelled the enemy again, And they were very proud of themselves, and the enemy seemed to be so impressed with him that they left this wooden horse there as a gift. And they took, in their pride, they took this wooden horse into the city with great pomp and ceremony and great celebration. Ha, look, we've conquered again. We are unconquerable. We've repelled the enemy. And they our enemies are so impressed with us, they even left us this wooden horse. And they took it into the city walls. And of course, we know what happened at night. The guys hiding in the wooden horse slipped out, killed the guards at the gate, opened the gate, signaled their comrades in the ships. They came up, streamed into the city, and conquered it. And Troy fell. The problem is our flesh is the Trojan horse that opens us up from the inside to the world, to the attacks of the world. Not only are we in the world, but there's a part of the world that is still in us. And you know this, if you've been a Christian for a while and trying to live as a Christian in this world for a while, you know that if someone looks closely enough at your behavior, they'll see that you still fall for temptation. Even worse, if someone looks closely enough at your thoughts and at your emotions, they'll see very clearly that you're not that holy. You don't look that holy. You don't think that holy. You don't feel that holy always. Right? Is it only me, or is there someone else here who's like that as well? You're all looking at me like this. What's wrong with you? Right? And yet, even though we know from experience that we're far from perfect, in verse 9, we're called a holy nation. Why? The grace of God. We're not holy because we're perfect. We're holy because in His grace God has made us His own. What does holy mean? We often define holy as when you're holy, you're separate from sin and sinners. But here's the thing. God was holy long before sin existed, right? Long before Satan fell, long before Adam and Eve fell, long before, Satan and mankind invented sin, God was holy. So you cannot define holiness in terms of sin. You cannot say it's to be separate from sin, because God was holy before sin existed. You've got to define holiness in terms of God. Think about it. Jerusalem is called the holy city. Israel is called the holy nation. The Bible is called the holy Bible. What do those three things have in common? Chosen by God, and they belong to God in a special way, right? The Bible is the holy Bible because it's the word of God. So holy means not separate from sin primarily, that's a secondary aspect of it, but separate unto God, belonging to God in a special way. And that's what it means that we are a holy nation. We belong to God in a special way. We're God's property. Even though we're not perfect like God is perfect, He has made us His own. He's made us holy unto Him. Holy nation. And then it says God's own possession, God's own special possession. Now the word there, God's own special possession, is a bit of a watered-down translation. I mean, you can hear from the verses that it's alluding to in the Old Testament that I read, like Exodus 19 and Deuteronomy 7 and so on, that it talks about God's treasured possession, right? You heard that, you remember that. And that's what the word means. It means treasured possession. And here's the thing, in the very next verse, in verse 10, 1 Peter 2 verse 10, it says, You had not received mercy, but now you've received mercy. You were not a nation, but now you're God's nation. It's actually a quote from Hosea 2 verse 23. Now, to understand that quote, you've got to understand what's going on in Hosea. Do you know the story of Hosea the prophet? You know, in fact, let me just read you a few verses there, because I think this is such a beautiful story. Now I must find it. Hosea is one of those minor prophets that usually hide somewhere towards the end of the Old Testament. Come on. Here we go. So God says to Hosea in Hosea 1 verse 2. And when the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, "Go, marry a promiscuous woman, and have children with her. For like an adulterous wife, this land is guilty of unfaithfulness to the Lord." So he married Gomer, daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. And what happened was he married his sister. And sometimes God, I don't know, God tells you to do things and you just think, no, God, you're not allowed to say that. You can't tell me to do that. That's wrong, God. He says to Abraham, "Don't sacrifice your son." No, God. You don't allow human sacrifice. You know? You can't tell me to go and sacrifice humans because it's against your law. God says to Hosea, "Go marry a promiscuous woman. Go marry a prostitute." You know? No, God. you know? Sometimes God tells us to do funny things. Well, these characters in the Bible. So he goes and he marries this Gomer. Has children with her, but I mean, some of the children, I mean, she clearly seems to be having affairs, because some of the children don't seem to be Hosea's. He even calls the one, "Not mine." He names one of the children, "Not my own, not my people." So, you know, she seems to be sleeping around, you know. And then in, let me just read chapter 2, verse 23, so you can see, you know, that it's being alluded to. "I will show my love to one I call, not my loved one. I will say to those called not my people, 'You are my people.' And they will say, 'You are my God.'" That's the verse being alluded to in 1 Peter 2 verse 10. And then in chapter 3 verse 1 and 2, let me just read that to you. It says, "The Lord said to me, 'Go show your love to your wife again, though she is loved by another man and an adulteress. Love her as the Lord loved the Israelites, which they, though they turned to other gods and loved the sacred raisin cakes.' So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver." So what we see happening here is, I don't know what exactly happened, whether she obviously had adulterous, you know, affairs and so on. Things didn't go well with her. Either she eventually sold herself into slavery because she got into debt or something, or one of her lovers abused her and sold her into slavery, but she ended up a slave. And God says to Hosea, "Go and buy her back. She's been sold into slavery, go and buy her back." Your own wife, who's being unfaithful to you, ended up in slavery because she was unfaithful. "Go and buy her back." And he goes and he buys her back for 15 shekels of silver. And what Peter is saying is, we're like Gomer. All of us, we're Gomer. When God says, "You are my own treasured possession," it's not because we've been so great. It's because He loved us and went and bought us out of the slavery that our prostitution and our adultery landed us under. That's how much He loved us. Can you see God's grace in this? Can you see His grace in this? His awesome grace. Now, think about this. While you're thinking about that, think about this. That word is treasured possession or prized possession. If a poor person says, "Now I've got this ring that I inherited from my mother, and it's got a nice big diamond on it. This is my treasured possession. I have nothing else. I don't have a home. I don't have much earthly possessions at all. I have, you know, my net worth is not very high, but I have this ring. This is my treasured possession. It doesn't say that much about the ring. But when someone who is stinking rich and has everything says something is their treasured possession, then it says a lot about that possession. Think about this. God owns everything. He owns the sea and all its wealth. He owns the mountains and all the diamonds, gold, and silver in it. He owns the sun, moon, and stars and all the heavens. Everything, all the beauty in the earth, He created it, belongs to Him. The nations belong to Him. He created them. Everything belongs to God. And in the context of everything belonging to Him, He says, you are my treasured possession. What does that say about how valued we are? Now think about this. A house, you don't buy a house. A house doesn't have like an objective price. There's no, you know, lists or other, you know, websites you can go to and look at a house, at an address, and at the house, a picture of the house, and say, objectively, this is what this house is worth. No. The house is worth whatever someone is willing to pay for it. Right? What was God willing to pay for us? He was willing to pay His own life for us on the cross. The gospel means that we are like Gomer, we are more sinful than we realize, and yet we are more loved than we deserve. We are a lot more sinful than we would dare to think, and we are a lot more loved than we would dare to imagine. That's what the gospel is, the gospel of the grace of God. Like Gomer, He bought us and made us His treasured possession. He's very humble. And unless we know that, unless we are loved like that, we know that we are loved like that, we cannot live as resident aliens in this hostile world. Unless we know that our holy God makes us a holy nation by loving us that much, by giving us that much grace, we can never live as a community of resident aliens in this hostile world. We need to know that. That is the thing that will sustain us. That is the thing that will carry us. That is the thing that will enable us to be different from the world. And that's why verse 23 says, Jesus suffered. See, He was willing to suffer. He's not going to assimilate to the world. He's not going to attack the world. He's not going to avoid the world. He's going to have close contact with the world. And that means suffering. Are you willing to suffer? Because if you want to be in the world, and yet not of the world, not become like the world, you're going to have to be willing to suffer. But that's the only way you're going to change the world. That's the only way you're going to be like Jesus or like the early church. And the only thing that can sustain us and empower us to do that is if we are convinced that we have received that grace. If we really have received that grace. If we really know that how loved we are by God. Then we can be like Jesus. And we can look like Jesus and say, well, if Jesus can do that for me, then I can do it for you by His grace. Let's stand. Father God, we just want to thank You, Lord, that we can come before You this morning. And Lord, we realize, Lord, that You love us a lot more than we deserve, and a lot more than we realize. We realize that our revelation of Your grace and of Your love for us is just the tip of the iceberg. We really don't have a clue. But Lord, we want to know. We want to know how much You love us. And we want to love You. We want to honor You the way that You deserve. And we thank You for Your grace that makes us a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, Your own treasured possession, so that we can declare the excellencies of Him who called us out of darkness into His marvelous light. Thank You that You called us out of darkness into Your marvelous light. Thank You that You made Your light marvelous.
close to us.
His grace by which he's already saved.